Chapter 22. Dual Personality. There is a popular misconception that the word schizophrenia means split personality. This is not so. It means a loss of contact with reality. The schizophrenic feels as if he's separated from reality by an invisible glass wall. On the other hand, all psychologists recognise that there is such a phenomenon as multiple personality, although there's some disagreement about its cause. A genuine dual personality is a rarity. Dr. Pritchard, the Victorian poisoner, has been called the benevolent monster. But this was not because he was a Jekyll and Hyde. He was a weakling, a braggart, and a liar, whose chief desire was to be famous. He poisoned his wife and her mother because he was tired of being married and wanted to be free to pursue his affairs with servant girls. Those two eminent burglars, Deacon Brodie and Charlie Peace, are altogether closer to the authentic dual personality. For while they burgled by night, they genuinely wanted to be respectable and respected citizens by day. As Robert Louis Stevenson recognised in his story of Jekyll and Hyde, the man with a split personality is to be pitied. Stevenson wrote the book in 1886, before psychologists had the basic concepts for understanding the workings of the divided man. These were provided by Sigmund Freud, with his recognition that the subconscious mind is an enormous hidden realm, containing impulses and desires that may be foreign to the conscious personality. Freud also formulated the classic theory of suppression, whereby some illicit desire or thought may be instantly thrust into the depths of the subconscious, only to fester there, like a splinter, until it erupts in the form of mental illness or some unexplainable violence. In Freud's view, most of these suppressions are sexual, although there are others. For example, death wishes directed against people who are close to us and whom we may consciously love and respect. The German sexologist Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld cites a typical example of a sudden eruption of suppressed desire. The patient was a 35-year-old doctor who had been subject to fits of epilepsy and of sleepwalking since childhood. The doctor was treating a 13-year-old schoolgirl for eczema, which covered the whole of her body. Hirschfeld writes, "He sat on the settee, drawing the child's head down to him. During this act, her whole body approached his and induced in him sexual excitement, accompanied by an erection. He now pressed the child close to himself. Of the rest of his actions, the defendant has no clear recollections. When he came to himself, he was sitting on the settee with the child, now in tears, standing between his legs." During this blackout, the doctor had made the child turn with her back to him, then inserted his penis between her closed thighs and moved it back and forth until he induced an orgasm. The account ends, "His mind did not clear until he reached his flat." Of course, it's possible that the doctor invented the story of the blackout, but it's just as likely that it's genuine. His fits of sleepwalking indicate that he had an unusually active subconscious mind. Epilepsy is a convulsive seizure due to electrical discharge of the brain. When the discharge occurs, the subject usually becomes unconscious, but may writhe in convulsions, foam at the mouth, or even attempt violence against another person. Dr. Gray Walter has cited a case of a man who, whenever he went to the cinema, had to fight off a strong impulse to strangle the person sitting next to him. On one occasion, he came to with his hands around his neighbour's throat. It was discovered that these seizures, epileptic in nature, were caused by the rate of flicker of the film. It's quite conceivable that, in the case of the doctor cited by Hirschfeld, his sexual excitement triggered a seizure. In a semi-somnambulistic state, he committed the offence against the child, then woke up, although he was still only partially conscious. The Sydney mutilator, William MacDonald, discussed in the chapter on homosexual killers, described his murder of a man that he'd casually picked up. He woke up in the middle of the night and picked up a knife. "As I stood looking at him, with the knife grasped firmly in my hand, a mad rage came over me. I knelt down and I stabbed him in the neck. I struck down at him again and again. During the stabbing, I accidentally struck my own hand, and then I lost count of how many times I thrust the knife into his body. Even after I knew he was dead, I kept on plunging the knife into him." This description certainly suggests that MacDonald had some form of seizure, not unlike that of the man in the cinema. Many criminal activities are associated with a brainwave known as the theta rhythm. These waves were first noticed in young children, and they became pronounced when the child experienced emotions of pleasure or pain. Theta rhythms could be easily evoked in a small child by offering a sweet and then snatching it away. In adults, these rhythms play a very small part, except in aggressive psychopaths. Greywalter comments about this sudden murderous violence towards other people or animals. These destructive or murderous episodes were often almost or completely unmotivated by ordinary standards. This is not, of course, to suggest that psychopathic violence, like McDonald's, is caused in some way by theta waves, as an epileptic attack is caused by an electrical discharge. Possibly the theta waves appear when the psychopath induces a certain state of mind in himself. McDonald had decided to kill the man before he went to sleep, and the blind rage came over him after he had picked up the knife. He had somehow triggered the attack in the way that a normal person can trigger sexual excitement by directing the thoughts towards sex. But all this, like the discoveries about the amygdaloid nucleus in the brain, the source of our aggressive instincts, suggests that many violent killers may be suffering from some physical imbalance of some kind that makes some people abnormally active and others sluggish and dull. And it could be connected with the kind of hormone activity that turns some women into nymphomaniacs and some men into satyrs. Now, this speculation is suggested by the fact that so many Jekyll and Hyde crimes are sexual. A quiet young Sunday school superintendent named Theodore Durant, genuinely devoted to the local Baptist church in San Francisco, invites a pretty girl into the church, strangles her, drags her to the belfry and rapes her, and then leaves the body neatly laid out with a block under the head. 10 days later, he takes another girl into the church library, has intercourse with her, apparently with her agreement, but still murders her and leaves her body behind a door. It's senseless. If he is simply a sex maniac, why doesn't he lure the girls to some remote spot? And why doesn't he try to hide the bodies? Obviously, he's taken over by a second self. Like Ed Gein, the kind little babysitter of Wisconsin who was overcome twice a year by the overpowering urge to dig up female corpses, violate them, and make waistcoats of their skin. The Jekyll and Hyde syndrome can also be seen clearly in the case of the Chicago murderer William Hirons, only 18 years old at the time of his arrest. Hirons had been sent to various correctional institutions for burglary. The motive was sexual. He broke in to steal women's underwear, and when he was finally caught, the attic of his house was found to be full of stolen panties. He soon reached the stage where actually climbing in through an open window could induce sexual excitement and even orgasm. On October the 1st, 1945, the 16-year-old Hirons, already a powerfully built, good-looking boy, broke into the apartment of a nurse, and when she interrupted him, struck her with an iron bar and tied her to a chair. He then left and went back to his classes at the University of Chicago, where he was known as a brilliant student. The police found fingerprints and wondered whether the unknown attacker could have been responsible for an unsolved murder that had taken place the previous June. A 43-year-old divorcee, Josephine Ross, had been found in her bed in her Northside apartment, a throat cut and with many stab wounds. It looked as if she'd been attacked by a burglar. Then, on December the 10th, 1945, a maid entered the sixth-floor apartment of the Pinecrest Residential Hotel and discovered a body draped over the bathtub. It was Frances Brown, and she had been shot and stabbed. Apparently, she had walked naked out of the bathroom and bumped into a burglar. Above the bed, someone had scrawled in lipstick, "For God's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." The odd thing was that the killer had dragged the body to the bath and washed off the bloodstains, just as the blood had been washed off the body of Mrs. Ross with wet towels. The detective in charge of the case warned his men, "He'll kill again unless we catch him." A month later, on January the 7th, 1946, the parents of 6-year-old Suzanne Danian went to her bedroom and found that she was missing from her bed. A ransom note demanded $20,000 and ordered, "Burn this for her safety." Police searched the area and Suzanne's head was found in a sewer. In other local sewers, police found more parts of her body. The killer had carried her down a ladder into a nearby basement and there strangled and dismembered her. He had then carefully washed the pieces of the body before disposing of them. The murders ceased for several months. On June the 26th, 1946, a janitor reported a young burglar in an empty apartment on the north side. Then he and another tenant tried to tackle the youth as he ran away. The man fired shots at them, but with the help of the police, he was finally overpowered. This was William Hirons, and at police headquarters, he explained that the murders were committed by a man called George. However, he admitted that he and George were simply aspects of the same personality. George periodically took over. On one occasion, Hirons had locked his clothes in the washroom and thrown the key inside so that he would be unable to go out on a burgling expedition. But George was too strong. He crawled along the house gutter to get the key and went out. He explained that his tension during a burglary was so great that if anyone interrupted him, he exploded into violence. Hirons was sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms in prison. Was Hirons a true Jekyll and Hyde, or was George merely an invention? Both could be true. George was a fantasy that Hirons invented to explain his own dual personality. It's impossible to know precisely how much control he had over his criminal alter ego. In one of the most famous cases of dual personality, an American housewife named Eve was periodically taken over by a brash, sexy, empty-headed female who loved a good time. Thigpen and Cleckley, describing the case in their book The Three Faces of Eve, call the two personalities Eve White and Eve Black. When Eve White was taken over, she simply lost consciousness and had no idea of what Eve Black did in her absence from her own body. Dr. Morton Prince had described an equally baffling case in the late 1890s. A girl named Christine Beauchamp, who, under hypnosis, became a totally different personality. The new personality called herself Sally, and apparently had a completely separate existence from Christine. Christine would wake up from a kind of amnesia, once in a strange city, and have to find out what Sally had been doing in her absence. Now, this case was further complicated by the emergence of a third, totally distinct personality who loathed Sally. The three women spent most of their time struggling for possession of Christine's body. Both Christine and Eve were partially, though never completely, cured through hypnosis and other treatment. Now, Hirons may have invented George, but why did he write, "For God's sake, catch me before I kill more," over Francis Brown's bed? Why did he leave fingerprints in several of the apartments as if in a frenzied or semi-dazed state? It's impossible to doubt that, in some sense, he was two people. Many Jekyll and Hyde murders have been the result of brain injury or physical degeneration. The Chinaman, Lok Ah Tam, was known as a kindly, reasonable businessman, until a drunken sailor struck him on the head with a billiard cue, knocking him senseless. After that, he became subject to sudden fits of blind rage, which ended in 1925 with the murder of most of his family. William Hepper was an artist and an ex-BBC translator, whose behaviour became unpredictable after a car accident in which he received head injuries. Hepper's wife, from whom he was separated, was a friend of the parents of an 11-year-old girl, Margaret Spevick. When the child broke her arm in February 1954, the parents were persuaded to allow him to take Margaret to Hove in Sussex to stay in his flat, where, he claimed, there was a resident nurse. They knew Hepper was a reliable, elderly man. He was 63, and they apparently felt no misgivings. 4 days later, Mrs. Spevick went to Brighton to see her daughter, arranging to meet her at the station, but neither Margaret nor Hepper was there. She went on to the flat in Western Avenue in Hove, and there found the strangled and raped body of her daughter on a divan. Nearby, on an easel, there was an unfinished portrait of her. Hepper was eventually caught in a hotel in Iran on the Spanish frontier. The defence at his trial argued that he was suffering from hallucinations and a loss of memory, and it was clear that this normally serious, balanced man was periodically subject to violent personality changes, but the jury found him guilty and he was executed. Undoubtedly, one of the most curious cases of a Jekyll and Hyde personality of recent years is that of the Jersey rapist Edward Penney. Just before midnight, on Saturday, July the 10th, 1971, 2 Jersey policemen were sitting in their patrol car at a traffic light when another car hurtled across the road in front of them against the amber light. They decided to give chase to the car, which was heading towards St Helier. They suspected it might have been stolen for a joyride by local youths. The driver ignored their signals to stop, struck an oncoming car a glancing blow, and roared off at 70 miles an hour. He began weaving from side to side to prevent the police from overtaking. Finally, after a chase of many miles, he turned into a private road, ran through a fence and across a garden, and into a field of tomatoes. The occupant leapt out and ran. One of the policemen brought him down with a rugby tackle. At the police station, they discovered that the man, who was middle-aged, had rows of nails, their points outwards, sewn into the lapels of his jacket. In his pockets, they found a wig, a rubber face mask and adhesive tape. The police realised suddenly that they had at last caught the man who had been committing rape on the island for many years, perhaps as many as 14. His name was Edward John Louis Payne. Back at his home, a farmhouse called Maison du Soleil, they discovered a secret room behind a bookcase. It contained a raffia cross, more masks, coats with nails, and black magic paraphernalia. When asked about this, Payne replied, "My master would laugh very long and loud about this." His master was the devil, and it later turned out that Payne was obsessed by Gilles de Rais, burned in 1440 for the murders of more than 50 children. The pattern of the crimes had been peculiar. In November 1957, three women had been attacked by a man with a knife, and one was sexually assaulted. In April 1958, a man threw a rope around the neck of a girl, dragged her into a field and raped her. In October 1958, a girl was dragged from a cottage and raped. The attacks ceased until 1960, and the police hoped that they had stopped, but then in January 1960, they took an altogether more alarming turn. A 10-year-old girl woke up to find a man in her bedroom. He warned her that if she cried out, he would shoot both her parents. He then sexually assaulted her in her own bed and left by the window, driving off in her father's car. When she told her brothers the next morning, they were inclined to believe that she had dreamt it all, a feature that recurred in some of the later cases. A month later, a man entered the bedroom of a 12-year-old boy, made him go out with him to a field, and committed a sexual assault. The rapist then took the boy back to the house and back to his bedroom. This was perhaps the oddest feature of all. Why should he risk being caught? It seemed that once he had committed his assault, the rapist became apologetic. For the next 11 years, Jersey became an island of terror. Householders had bolts and bars put on their windows. In March 1960, a 24-year-old air hostess waiting at a bus stop was dragged into a field and raped. On April the 27th, the woman, whose husband was in hospital, heard a noise in the middle of the night and found a man in her kitchen. The woman's 14-year-old daughter came downstairs and a rope was thrown around her throat. She was dragged out to a nearby field and raped, and then allowed to go home. In this, as in many succeeding attacks, it became clear that the rapist had studied the house and knew how to achieve his object with the minimum of risk. He often wore the terrifying rubber mask. Usually, the children were too frightened to scream. The man would commit a sexual assault and then courteously escort them back to their bedrooms. In some cases, penetration was minimal. He was evidently worried about hurting his victims. But at least one girl became pregnant. When 11-year-old Joy Norton was found stabbed to death in September 1965, it was feared that the rapist had at last turned to murder. But it was discovered that she had been sexually abused over a period of years, and her elder brother was charged with her murder. And so the rape and assaults continued, usually at the rate of one or two a year, until Payne was caught. One man who was generally suspected of the assaults had been so ostracised that he'd been forced to leave the island. Altogether, Payne was charged with 7 sexual assaults, including rape and sodomy. Found guilty, he was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment. But what baffled all those who knew him was that the kind Edward Payne, the man who genuinely loved children and often played Father Christmas at parties, should also be the rapist who had terrorised the island. Was Payne genuinely a devil worshipper? The question is perhaps irrelevant. The Jekyll and Hyde personality is one of the great mysteries of psychology. But at least, thanks to Freud, Jung and other psychologists, we now know more than Dr. Prince knew about Christine Beauchamp. If present-day advances continue, it is hopeful that Mr. Hyde will be banished from the soul, and the beneficent Dr. Jekyll will be in control.